comes the Dr. Catherine Albrecht Show. 2 hours of mentally stimulating, thought-provoking, sometimes maddening, but hopefully always inspiring talk radio. I am your host, Dr. Catherine Albrecht, and today is Friday, November 21st, a little less than 24 hours before I'm going to be standing out, freezing in the cold, objecting to the Federal Reserve. Yes, and the Fed, after a countdown of, what are we doing here, like 6 weeks, I think, that I've been personally counting this thing down, 11-22-08, people all around this country are going to be turning out to their local, their regional, Federal Reserve facilities. I almost want to call them, what do they always call it when you've got your home, and then they refer to it as a fortress, as a compound, when it's just a house. Well, you know, in the case of the Federal Reserve, it is a compound, and we are going to be standing out front of those compounds around the country protesting not just the policies of the Federal Reserve, but I got to tell you, the very existence of this absolutely insanely corrupt institution that is not federal, has no reserves, and essentially is just a fancy government-sanctioned way to print money, just like counterfeiters. You know, you go down to your basement, crank up the old printing press. Whenever you need a little more money, you run out of cash, print up a couple $100 bills. You know, I was at the store today, and they actually ran that little counterfeit pen over a 20. It's like, you got to be kidding me. Come on. And another store I was at, I did some shopping today. Another store I was at, I whipped out a $100 bill to pay. And the woman at the cash register said, oh, well, we don't even have change for that. And she's calling the manager, and she's calling people over. And, you know, the woman behind me is kind of tapping her foot. And I'm thinking, you know, you're a store. Aren't you supposed to have change? What's the deal here? You're a store. And she says, well, you know, most people use the machine over there. And she points to the little swipe, credit card swipe machine. And I'm realizing, indeed, you know, we are so irresponsible when it comes to our money in this country. Turning over control of it on a large scale to a bunch of bankers who could care less about the state of this country and with the Federal Reserve. And then on the individual level, not even thinking through the privacy and ultimately the freedom implications of our payment systems. Totally scary stuff. All right, let me give out the phone number here, 1-800-259-9231. Of course, you know my email address is KMA, that's KM like Mary, A at spychips.com. In case you're going, what's the spychips.com? That is the book, the best-selling award-winning book, which is the definitive critique of radio frequency identification, or RFID, probably the biggest and most crucial privacy issue and freedom issue ultimately facing us all today. And that's why you can find us at spychips.com, my website, CatherineAlbrecht.com. All right, we've got a great show lined up for you today. I'm going to be talking about ending the Fed. I got a whole bunch of personal stories that I've been kind of saving up and hope I can jam into this first hour. And then in the second hour, we are going to be visited by Daniel B. Smith. He is the author of a book that I talked about on the show back on Halloween when we did the show on hearing voices. You guys remember that? Played kind of some scary music and talked about all the people who call me up and believe that they've been implanted with something that can plant messages and voices in their heads. And I mentioned this book, Muses, Prophets, and Madmen. I think I got it backwards. Muses, Madmen, and Prophets. There we go. And Daniel B. Smith, the author of the book, well, I went ahead and got myself a copy of the book, and I have since read it cover to cover. It is one of the best written books. I mean, talk about actual, you know, just writing talent. This guy's really got it. He's gone on, and he's got a big article out now in the New York Times Magazine. So he's a terrific writer. And unfortunately, oftentimes, terrific writers don't make the best radio guests because it's kind of a different skill set to be able to write well versus being able to speak well. But I just got off the phone with Dan Smith, and he is as absolutely fascinating to talk to as he is to read. So I think you're going to get a kick out of that. We're going to be talking about the phenomenon of hearing voices, and by that I mean the literal in your head sound of someone else's voice speaking to you, the sound of other stuff going on inside your head that has no basis in reality around you. So he'll be joining us at the top of the next hour, about 50 minutes from now. So please stay with me, because I promise you that's going to be an absolute eye-opening, fascinating discussion. In the meantime, I want to know, are any of you guys planning on going to your local End the Fed event? Are you going to be part of this? Because here in New Hampshire, our nearest Federal Reserve, of course, we got one of these things down in Boston, and I know it very well. I actually gave a speech. I gave a talk. I participated. I guess you'd call it kind of a debate with Mark Roberti from the RFID Journal. Big industry apologist. I love that word, and it fits in this case. Apologist is someone who sort of defends an industry or defends a belief system against critiques. And in this case, he definitely had a lot of defending to do and a lot of apologizing to do, I must say, even though that's not really the meaning of the word apologist, but it certainly fits in this case. He had a lot of apologizing to do because the RFID industry has been just appallingly out of line and very, very scary stuff that they have and had been doing. So I debated him down at this Federal Reserve, and it was an invitation from the Federal Reserve itself. This was a couple years ago. And I drove down to Boston, it's near South Station, kind of. It's a big, kind of a bustling business environment down there. And the place is a fortress. You know, I referred to it a little while ago here as a compound. And compound doesn't even begin to do this place justice. It's got big wrought iron, you know, the big spiky things that kind of point outward so you can't climb them. It's got a big wrought iron fence, not even a fence, like a tire than a fence, like a wrought iron wall around it. It has its own security force, which is a little bit disturbing. And getting in there was like getting into a fortress. I did not show ID. I don't believe I did, because I have a policy that I don't show ID for anything. So I'm sure that had they demanded ID, I would have refused to go in. So they must not have asked for ID. But I do remember that they asked for my name, which, you know, I figured they can know that. They'll see me up on a stage here in a couple of minutes. So I gave them my name. They printed me out a little badge on this high-tech equipment that they had, and they put me through a metal detector. So it was like getting on an airplane. I had to walk through a metal detector. I had to take my purse and my briefcase and put them on a little X-ray machine that went through the little thing just like at the airport. Little security scan, so they x-rayed me. I mean, they pretty much did everything except have a dog, you know, sniff me up and down. That's the one thing they didn't do, but I'm sure if occasion warranted, they probably could have produced a dog pretty quickly. And even then, once I got through all of that, they escorted us to the location just to make sure that, you know, even those of us who'd been invited speakers didn't go wandering down any hallways we weren't supposed to be in, or, I don't know, using any restrooms we weren't authorized to walk in. I don't know. But anyway, they led me into this place. And here's my favorite story on the Federal Reserve. My favorite story, Federal Reserve, is that while I'm there, this is like 2003, I think, 2003, maybe early 2004. And while I'm there, I'm talking, of course, about RFID, and I give a presentation, I'm discussing it. And I happen to have an RFID tag on my possession. And these things were really hard to come by. They're like hen's teeth. I mean, you know, at that time. Now you can find them anywhere. You can order them online in bulk. But back then, it was a pretty big deal to have one of these. And I kept it for demonstration purposes. And I thought, well, you know, I'll hand it out. So I handed it to the person in the front row, thinking it'd make its way back to the back row, and then I'd get it back, right? You know, after all, I'm in a building with, like, mega high security. Everybody in there has been through the metal detector. Anyway, long story short, at the end, when I asked for my tag back, it vanished. Somebody stole my RFID tag at the Federal Reserve. Is that a great story or what? All right, we'll be right back. Take your phone calls right after this. 1-800-259-9231. KMA at spychips.com. Don't go away. Do you appreciate the insights you gain each day from the Dr. Catherine Albrecht Show? If so, please consider helping us with a financial gift in any amount.
For nearly 2 years, I've aired a daily radio show bringing encouragement, education, and enlightenment to thousands of listeners around the globe. While I could be earning a major salary with my Harvard doctorate, I volunteer my time on the air as a labor of love, earning not a penny in exchange. Since 1999, I've also volunteered thousands of hours of research and leadership on privacy and freedom issues that affect us all. I've never taken a corporate handout or drawn a salary, but instead I've relied on the support of like-minded people like you. We all rely on good people to get by in hard times. I tithe 10% of my income, including gifts I receive, to worthy causes. Won't you consider doing the same? For information on how you can help, go to KatherineAlbrecht.com and click on Make a Gift. Your conscience will thank you for it.
This is the GCN Radio Network, home to hard-hitting talk radio.
With his own brand of Hate and Banks. I got to tell you, my brand of Hate and Banks is going to have me standing out there tomorrow in front of the Federal Reserve Building in Boston at, I think we're going to get out there around 9 o'clock in the morning and probably stand out there until we can't feel our fingers. Then we'll go back in. We're going to be near South Station giving out literature and informing people about the problems with the Federal Reserve, the monetary system, and letting people know that they can pin the blame on a lot of these financial problems, the economy, the loss of jobs, the foreclosures on homes, and all the rest, on the people behind those wrought iron fences. Yeah, that's what we're going to be doing. And I'd love to hear from you if you are planning on turning out to one of these End the Fed events. Love to hear from you. Maybe I can talk you into it if it's something you would consider doing and then thought, well, you know, I don't know. Is it going to make a difference? The answer is that yes, if you have an opportunity to turn out for one, by all means, you not only should, but it's kind of your moral obligation to do it, because that's the only way people are going to learn, and that's the only way we're going to make a difference. You've got to be the change you want to see in the world. You know that old cliche. It's true. It's absolutely true. And believe me, I don't particularly want to go. I'm not looking forward to this. This is not my idea of, like, the high point of my weekend is getting out there and freezing in front of a Federal Reserve building. But it's something that I know I absolutely need to do. So if you want to learn more, go to endthefed.us, endthefed.us. Gary Franchi, we had him on the program a while back, from Restore the Republic, is the mastermind and the organizer behind this event, this nationwide event tomorrow. Of course, you probably know Gary Franchi, or you may know Gary Franchi and his Restore the Republic organization, because it is the
The Fruit that was born from Aaron Russo's film America, From Freedom to Fascism, which I had the good fortune to be a co-star in and to be a part of that movie and work closely with Aaron Russo, rest his soul. And this is really, I wish Aaron Russo were still with us today so that he could see how much his movie has impacted this world. And now, after tomorrow, many, many, many thousands and hopefully millions of additional people by means of the media will begin to catch on to the fact that this Federal Reserve is really a fiasco. All right, I have the phone lines open, 1-800-259-9231. My email again, kma@spychips.com. Would love to hear to anybody, from anybody, who's going to turn out at an end of the Fed event, or if you're on the fence, call me up, maybe I can talk you into it. And also, because Friday's kind of a grab bag day, I want to open up other topics. If there's something else on your mind we didn't get to this week and you want to throw it out there, now would be a really good time to do it. All right, let's go directly to Ryan listening to us in Maryland on the internet. Hey, Ryan.
Hey, how's it going?
Hi, going good. What's on your mind?
My main concern was I was in the Marine Corps 4 years ago, and I've been out for a while now, and I live in Howard County, Maryland. I believe I saw on Wikipedia is one right near Columbia, Maryland. I think Wikipedia had it as one of the eighth highest or most richest cities, but there really isn't much crime in Howard County, yet I have to watch my speed limit. I usually do, but, I mean, I really, really have to watch my speed limit because they have cops everywhere. I mean, they have them everywhere, and these guys are young like me, even younger than me, and they pull you over for everything, not wearing a seatbelt. If you're going just even a little bit over the speed limit for having a light out. And then also I'm starting to notice, I think a couple of years back, they put in red light cameras, and a lot of people were saying, you know, red light cameras cause more accidents than, you know, if we didn't have them. But now they're having, on top of the traffic lights, there are these little cameras everywhere. And
yeah,
I'm just wondering, do you happen to have any clue maybe what they could be there for? Because, I mean, they're putting them everywhere, and at least here in Columbia, in the Howard County.
Yeah, it's really, there's been a shift in the last probably decade or so towards trying to take away the anonymity of being able to hop in your car and drive. And it disturbs me because, you know, under the Soviets, they had an internal passport that was really used to control people and prevent there from being gatherings or protests or things like what we're going to be doing tomorrow at the Federal Reserve banks, because you had to get permission to go anywhere other than your prescribed route. So you were allowed to go from your home to your work, you know, pick up your kids at school, I guess, if we modernize the equation today. And everything else required a permit. Well, in order to put a system like that into place, you've got to be able to track the vehicles. And what's happening right now, the cameras that are going up, because we've got them here in Nashua, right here in New Hampshire, on the southern border of Massachusetts, there's some really disturbing, you know, all of the intersections have these little cameras that aim down at the cars. And then we've even got this really tall, I mean, it's as tall as a huge cell phone tower. It looks like something straight out of 1984. It has multiple cameras up on top, and they're all aimed down at the cars in all different directions. And this thing is up so high that they've got to have an amazing resolution on there, because otherwise, you know, we probably look like ants from the height of this thing. So the short answer to your question is they're going up to monitor traffic for traffic control purposes. You can go on, California's doing this, Texas is doing it. You can actually log onto a website, and you can find out what the traffic looks like on your commuter route as a way to minimize your
right.
commute.
Right.
So you can log on, and you can see, well, you know, what does the 210 freeway look like in California? The ones that they're putting into the cities, they're doing the same thing. They're monitoring traffic flow. But, of course, the long-term concern is that they can also grab your license plate numbers and process those automatically and make a big database of who drove by when. So if they're ever looking for you down the road, you're easy to find. So, yeah,
right.
We're coming up on a break. Stay with us. We'll be right back on the other end of this.
Okay.
Cascadia Public Radio.
right, we're back. You're listening to the Dr. Catherine Albrecht Show on Genesis Communications Network. You can catch this show or a rebroadcast of it at gcnlive.com. And as I pointed out earlier, we got a great show lined up for you today talking about kind of a grab bag of issues right now. I'm all excited and geared up for the End the Fed event tomorrow. That's online at endthefed.us. And I'm going to be heading down to Boston to protest out in front of the Federal Reserve, along with a lot of my cold and frozen, very dedicated colleagues. Should be great. I'm looking forward to it. We're going to bring some, I don't know, a thermos full of hot chocolate and another one full of coffee, I think, to keep our hands warm. Because what was it? It was like 18 degrees this morning when I got up. I know. You Texans are all going, what? I was talking to my mom in California. She's like, it's 88 degrees here. How are we going to do this big outdoor thing she's planning? She says, we're all just going to bake. And I thought, man, outdoor things, we all freeze to death. So it's a big country. It's a big, big country with lots of different regions in it, I'll tell you. Let's see. Other exciting things in this program. We've got Daniel B. Smith joining us in the second hour, author of Muses, Mad Men, and Prophets, to talk to us about hearing voices. Should be fascinating. All right, I've got Ryan still holding in Maryland. Ryan, are you still with me?
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, we were talking about those cameras, and you brought up something before the break that I wanted to kind of touch on. You were saying in your community in Maryland that it's actually a good community, that you don't have a lot of crime there. You feel safe in your neighborhood?
Yeah, that's the main point I was trying to get at. I mean, I'm sure there is, you know, a little bit of crime, but I live right near Prince George's County, which is where most of all the crime is, and it just doesn't make sense when, you know, they're talking about how people are losing their houses and people aren't spending that much money. And
I know, why are we spending all this money on this whacked out infrastructure? And what's happening is that a lot of the funds for doing traffic surveillance is coming from matching grants through the federal government. It's the same kind of a program that is providing what are called resource officers in the schools, where you can actually have a full-time police officer in a school. Usually in the better neighborhoods is where they wind up doing this. All of this money that seems to be so wasteful is coming in from the federal government. So it is being taken from our pockets in the form of our income taxes and other federal taxes, and it's being redistributed in these very specific ways designed to use your local government to turn into Big Brother on the federal government's behalf. But the reason I wanted to bring up the issue of the safety of your community, if you go down... I remember when I was visiting with Pastor Steve Upshur back in May of this year in Detroit, on the streets of Detroit in the ghetto, in the worst part of town, there were no police. I did not see a single police officer the entire time I was there. And yet you can go to a safe community with wealthy people and you will see police swarming everywhere. It's like a plague of locusts, of cops. And you have to ask yourself, what exactly... What purpose is it that these police are serving, other than to reassure the folks in the wealthy communities who have been scared out of their minds by CNN and Time Magazine and USA Today and everybody else into believing that there is a terrorist or a mugger or a child abductor behind every bush? And yet where the real terrorists and the real muggers and the real child abductors are, there's no police presence at all. So it's really kind of ironic.
Right. Well, yeah, I agree with... I'm not sure about Detroit, but I know I live right near Baltimore City, and Baltimore City is kind of opposite. If you go down to Baltimore City, they have cameras everywhere in certain areas, in certain sections of the city where, you know, there's nonstop murders and all. But it just really makes no sense that they have so many here, and they could I can't even imagine how much money they're spending on these cameras and the upkeep and whoever they contract out to go and repair them and make sure they're working and monitor them. And I mean, it just doesn't make any sense. We really don't need them if our economy is in such a bad, you know, state right now. It doesn't make any sense at all to me.
Well, then you can kind of go back to the conversation that I had in a previous show where I was talking about bad jobs, people who are working jobs that are unethical and immoral. The one thing you can say about this entire security infrastructure, not just on the local level of installing cameras everywhere, but on a global level of engaging in wars overseas and engaging in this endless war on terror, is it does create jobs. It does, believe it or not, it does stimulate the economy. Not that that's a good thing, not that I want my economy stimulated with dirty money, but it's employing people. I mean, somebody's got to make the cameras. Someone's got to run the wiring to them. Someone's got to drive the truck that gets the equipment out to the place to put it in there. Somebody's got to push the papers to actually make all that happen. Somebody's got to do the IT work and create the computer infrastructure to make the database that's going to store all of that. And all of those money-making opportunities, in many cases, are being driven by lobbying interests. They have lobbyists, and they send those lobbyists up at the highest levels of government to lobby, hey, we've got a national security problem. Hire us. Give us a $220 million contract for just the first phase of real ID driver's licenses. So, you know, you've got this huge sums of money changing hands. I take that back. That was $220 million that went out for the RFID tag driver's licenses, the border crossing cards with RFID in them. So, you know, if there's a $220 million potential contract, you better believe that these companies are going to lobby like crazy to try to be on the receiving end of that kind of money. And it creates kind of a circular environment. Because if you give a company $220 million to put RFID tags in driver's licenses, it's going to use a big chunk of that to fund campaign contributions. It's going to use a big chunk of that to hire more lobbyists to even fill up the halls of power even more, take people out to expensive dinners, invite them, on yacht trips and the like, and then you wind up kind of with this accelerating cycle. And so I think that's a big part of it, but I would point out that the argument they would make is that installing those cameras actually is building and growing the economy, but kind of in a creepy way.
Well, why don't they, instead of wasting money on cameras that are really not necessary, start building some solar panels or setting up solar panels and other free energy technology somewhere, or even funding people to look into that? And maybe that's obviously suppressed because of the oil company and all that, but they can still get their money if they play it right.
Well, so here's the deal, and this is pretty consistent. I've talked about this before. If you want to know where the future's going, there's a couple of ways you can do it. But one of them, it's like if you're standing on a bridge and you drop a little paper boat into the bridge, into the river, you pretty much can predict the future as to where that little boat's going to wind up. Well, at this point in time right now, in the year 2008, if you drop money into the economy, it's going to wind up in one of just a few places, because the river of history is flowing towards Big Brother control, surveillance of everything, everywhere, all the time, and constant round-the-clock marketing. So if you have a new technology and you want to know where it's going to wind up, you can bet your bottom dollar it's going to wind up in one of those places. Now, we don't have right now, the current of history is not flowing towards more and better sources of energy, unfortunately. It's still flowing in that, in that petroleum direction. But that's really why I think these technologies are going there. When they're trying to grow the economy, they're going to grow it with more marketing and more surveillance. So anyway, I appreciate the call. Thanks for weighing in with that. All right. We'll be right back.
We are building a religion. We are building it bigger. We are widening the corridor and adding more lanes. We are building a religion, a limited edition. We are now accepting callers for these pendant keychains.
Resistance is useless. You know, that message, woo, if you buy into that message, you won't lift a finger to do a thing. In fact, I think that's responsible for a whole lot of depression. And one of the cool things about getting in touch with Daniel B. Smith, he is an author with Penguin. Penguin was his publishing house. They also, of course, published the paperback version of my book, Spy Chips. But I get in touch with this PR person. I got this other great book in the mail that they sent, saying maybe you're interested in this too, and it's about natural solutions to depression. So that's my next big read. I won't even give you the name of it till I've actually read it and I can vouch for it and report back and tell you that it's good. But yesterday I got into a little bit of my reading. I have the Great Books of the Western World. Man, you know, I was saying to my husband, I wish we could go on a second honeymoon. Right? This is just to give you a sense of like what a party animal I am. Right? I want a second honeymoon. I want to go to a tropical island. I want to be wined and dined. And I want to take these 100 books with us. What I'm going to do is all the entire time, not that I can even afford to do this, but my dream of a second honeymoon is my husband, me, and the 100 greatest books of the Western world. And endless time to read them out loud to each other, talk about them, and just sink our teeth into all of the juicy information in these books. And I'm talking about all the stuff that we should have been taught, that should have been just like breathing, should have been part of our regular education growing up, all of the great thoughts that have been distilled out of thousands of years, literally thousands of years of human thought and human insight, human wisdom, human philosophy, human, the cream of the crop in the best sense of the word. And instead, we're being fed pablum, worse than pablum. You know what pablum is? Pablum is back when, do they even still have pablum? I don't think they do now. But back, I don't know, the 1950s, it was this baby formula, this baby food. You just kind of stir it up with a little bit of water, a little bit of milk, and it was completely flavorless, like library paste, like wallpaper paste. Pablum. And that's what they're feeding us today. We are not being fed. We're not being nurtured intellectually with great thoughts and great ideas and the wisdom of the ages. We're being fed pablum, created by committee, by bureaucrats, and spooned out in these like 15-pound textbooks that our high school and junior high school kids have to lug around to the point where they're having back problems and scoliosis from carrying these books that contain nothing. Pictures. Picture of a whale. I mean, I'm already like half ADD prone anyway. I'm looking through these books with my students because I work with junior high and high school students. And I'm flipping through the book and all of a sudden there's like a story, a picture with a caption that has nothing to do with anything that we're studying. I'm like, oh, there's a whale and look, oh, that's where the blow spout is. And meanwhile, we're trying to learn, you know, algebraic equations. So it's just useless garbage. I mean, not that whales and blow spouts aren't fascinating. Of course they are. But what does it have to do with math? It's like ADD central. It's like they're trying to make our kids ADD spaced out. And meanwhile, they're not feeding them real food. It's like they're feeding the kids pablum and Cheetos and Skittles and sugar-free gum and Coke and Diet Coke instead of giving them real solid meals. And in the same way that you can look around and you can see the outcome of this on children, on young people, on adolescents, on people in their 20s, people in their 50s, everybody, you can look around and you can tell who's been sucking down garbage into their bodies. You know, their minds look the same way. They do. You see a bunch of, you know, pimply-faced 16, 20-year-olds, pasty, out of shape, overweight, look like they haven't exercised, haven't eaten a vegetable in 10 years. And if you want to understand the internal state of the mind of the average American, you're dealing with the same phenomenon. They have not ingested mentally, intellectually, anything of any content or substance, probably since the day they were born. So, I talk about party animal me. I'm the total party animal. I want to sit around and actually get some of the substance that I missed out on in school. And I went to really good schools, you know, quote unquote. I went to really quote unquote good schools. I went to private school. I went to, you know, I mean, I was well educated, quote unquote. And yet I was never exposed to any of this stuff. And, you know, to the extent I was, my culture had taught me as a kind of a snotty teenager, and believe me, I went through that phase in spades, but as a snotty teenager, my culture taught me that anything that came from adults was just supposed to be ignored anyway. And if you can get by cheating and being lazy and pretending to have read the book, you don't need to actually sit down and read that stuff that they assign you. So even when my teachers, well-intentioned, gave me good literature and good things to read, I probably went in one ear and out the other. I probably didn't even absorb it or pay attention to it. And it's such a treat now as an adult to go back and pick up some of those books that I supposedly read in eighth or ninth grade and just enjoy them and just bask in them, just let those ideas flow and think, man, I was such an idiot not to have appreciated this the first time around. So anyway, I've got all these fabulous and wonderful books, and there's another book that I want to mention, as long as I'm kind of a grab bag Friday here and I can talk about open windows. It's called The Unexpected Legacy of Divorce, a 25-year landmark study. Un- unexpected legacy of divorce. I really want to expand on this topic because, as I've mentioned earlier this week, a very dear friend of my family's, a friend of my husband's actually, has been served with divorce papers. And both wonderful people, the husband and the wife, I have the highest regard for both of them, but they allowed their marriage to deteriorate. They allowed things to get out of control. And at this point, what's really surprising to me, and I guess the thing I want to kind of set people straight on, is that divorce, when you're in that state of wanting to get divorced and end a marriage, you can actually convince yourself of some pretty serious lies. And one of the lies that is so prevalent in our society is that divorce is the best thing for children. You know, it's better for them to be apart, better for them to see us apart than to live in a house full of fighting, or that's one you hear. Now, another one you hear is, I really want my children to see that women can be strong and they can walk away from marriages that aren't working out. And I don't want to send them the wrong message to be a wallflower and stick around in a bad marriage. And I was trying to see, are these things actually true? There's apparently books out there that will train you in how to get a divorce and how to accustom yourself to the idea of dumping your marriage. And they're just evil. I mean, they're truly evil. Just the information in them, very, very disturbing. And I'm certainly not advocating people stay in, you know, marriages where they're being violently beaten up or whatever. But the reality is marriage is hard. I mean, there's lots of times you don't want to be married. Lots of times you go, what did I do? Why am I with you? All the time. You know, it's just part of living. I look in the mirror and feel that way half the time. But when you look at this study, this book, Unexpected Legacy of Divorce, a 25-year landmark study, what you find is that far from sending a positive message to your children, that divorce has enormous, enormous repercussions throughout life. And they don't happen right away. Kids seem to be doing okay within a year or 2 years after a divorce, but you look at them long term. They've done this longitudinal study based on people who got divorced as far back as 1971. And they've been following these children throughout their adulthood, and they have found that the repercussions of divorce on them have been unbelievably damaging, absolutely damaging. Because, you know, as adults, you can say, well, it's a marriage, it didn't work out, I'm going to walk away. But as a kid, your family is your life. It's the center, it's the core of your very existence. And to have it broken up and torn apart leaves you with long-lasting feelings of insecurity. And I almost wonder if this national obsession with security, the fact that we're all just like being convinced and so easily manipulated with a security button, is not because we are now a nation of adult children of divorced parents. You know, my parents are divorced. I went through it. Mortifying. And even reading this book was like reopening all these wounds that, you know, I didn't even realize I had. So those of you out there, I wanted to say this because I'm sure that somewhere out there in my listening audience are people who are contemplating divorce, and I would urge you, before you make a single move, or if someone is trying to impose a divorce on you, grab a copy of this book, The Unexpected Legacy of Divorce, a 25-year landmark study. Unexpected Legacy of Divorce. Get a copy and read it before you make a single move or call a lawyer, because it's worth it. Stay together for the kids. It's real. All right. You're listening to Dr. Catherine Albrecht on the Genesis Communications Network. We'll be right back with Daniel B. Smith to talk about his amazing book about hearing voices, muses, madmen, and prophets right after this. Stay with us. We'll be taking your phone calls, and it should be a riveting conversation. You won't want to miss it.
Back. You are listening to the Dr. Catherine Albrecht Show, and we've got quite an hour lined up for you here. Get you in the mood there with a little bit of mood music about hearing voices. You may recall a couple of weeks ago I did a whole show about the phenomenon of people who believe that they are persecuted in various ways, that voices speak to them inside their heads, whether they're the voices of the federal government speaking to them through an implant or the voices from aliens in some cases, voices
voices that come from places that cannot quite be described. And as a result of that conversation, I went ahead and got a copy of the book Muses, Madmen, and Prophets. And the author of that book will be our guest this hour, Daniel B. Smith, the book published not long ago by the Penguin Press. Absolutely interesting, fascinating read, giving me a lot of insight into this. And joining us this hour is the author of the book, Dan Smith. Are you there, Dan?
I'm here.
Hey, well, it's terrific to have you on the program. I got to tell you, you are an extraordinarily gifted writer. I really enjoyed reading your book.
Oh, that's very kind of you to say. Thank you.
Well, and my reason for reading it, you know, I wanted to sit down and really, I was hoping by the end of the book that I would have a handle on this whole voice hearing phenomenon that you say that like up to 3% of people have actually experienced this. But by the time I finished your book, I actually found myself having more questions than I did even before.
Well, that was my experience, and I'm the one who wrote the book. I think it happens to be one of those experiences, one of those phenomena that just open up more doors in terms of questions than tend to be answered as you move along.
Well, I'll tell you what. Tell our listeners how you got started in how you developed an interest in this topic in the first place.
Yeah, sure. So for many years, for about 20 or 25 years before he passed away for no related reason, my father heard voices. It was something that it turns out he was extremely ashamed of, so ashamed, in fact, that he didn't tell anyone for about 15 years, I think, or so. He started hearing voices when he was around 12 or 13 and went on and lived a fairly normal and conventional life. He got married. He had three children. He went to college and then to law school and had a career. But all along, he was hearing voices on a daily basis. Until the silence, I think, became so much for him, the secrecy became so much for him that eventually he hospitalized himself, not so much for the voices, but for depression and anxiety and all the things that came along with hiding this from his family. Even after that time, though, and up to the time that he died of cancer about a decade ago, he was extremely ashamed that he wouldn't really answer any questions. So in order to understand what he'd gone through, I set out to understand it myself. And it's sort of the same reason that a lot of people write books, I think, because if there was a book out there that had explained it to them, they wouldn't need to write the book, but there didn't happen to be one. And especially there didn't seem to be one that was a sort of apologia for people who have that experience and who are not psychotic. Of course, that's a sort of loaded term, and there are a lot of questions that come up about it, but my father's voices weren't of the sort that people usually think of when you think of voices. They weren't persecutory. They were pretty mundane. From what I can tell from his medical records that I was able to get hold of, they just told him to follow certain simple commands, like moving a glass from one side of the table to the other. But he was really troubled by the stigma associated with the experience. And he said to my mother at some point after he was hospitalized, she said, "Why didn't you tell me?" And he said, "I didn't think you'd marry me. You'd think that I was insane." Of course, it was very likely that she might have, considering its cultural association with the experience.
You know, that's one of the wilder parts of the story, is that you could actually have this experience, and because it's such a personal experience inside of one's own head, that you could actually raise children and be married and have a wife who doesn't even know that this is happening.
Yeah, it's remarkable. And one of the things that he discovered later on, and I didn't learn this until after he died, and I began to interview or possibly interrogate my mother, it depends on who you're asking, about the experience that he discovered. Well, maybe I should start with the story. When I was around 16 or so, my father's father had written a memoir, a sort of, you know, that he wanted to just pass along to his children, his children's children, and so on. Within this, there was a very brief section called Voices, in which my grandfather described how all throughout his life he had heard voices. And he had a much sort of lighter attitude about it. I think he used the voices to help him at the racetrack and playing gin rummy in a retirement community in Florida. And my father was enraged when he read this, because he thought if he had known this when he was a kid, terrified, thinking that he must be crazy and that other people must think him crazy if he were to tell people about this, it would have saved him years and years of grief. And I don't know I mean, I know that he flew down to Florida to speak to his own father about this and confronted him and that they discussed it, but I don't know what came of that discussion because my father continued to be silent. But both of them, it turns out, none of my brothers hear voices and are probably past the age when they usually begin, so probably won't. But, and there turn out to be many people who hear voices on a regular basis, who live perfectly normal lives, and who are more troubled about what the experience means than to others than what it means to themselves. Of course, that colors the experience itself after a while.
Well, now, and for our listeners who have not had the benefit of reading your book, explain just a little bit what you mean when you say hearing voices.
Well, that might be another long answer, I'm afraid. There are lots of different ways that you can hear voices, and one of the difficulties I came across when I started to do my reading and started to write about the subject was that there are so many different subsets to the experience. I mean, when I had started, I thought of it in terms of hearing voices outside of your head, as if someone right next to you were speaking. But what becomes abundantly clear when you begin to talk to people who say that they hear voices is that there's a whole range of experiences within that. That, in fact, it's not always that they hear voices outside their head. A lot of times when people say that they're hearing voices, what they're hearing are, sometimes they hear it within the precincts of their own skull, sometimes just a very powerful thought. I think that the sort of what unifies all the experiences, no matter what, I guess, the phenomenology of it is that it's a verbal expression that feels as if it doesn't come from one's own self. That it doesn't come from one's own will. You know, when someone speaks and we hear it, it's very easy to track that back. These voices seem as if they come from something other than the person themselves. Sometimes, when people say that they hear the voice of God, which is of course a very strong subset of this experience, if you begin to question them about it, a lot of times it's simply a metaphor. It's a metaphor for a powerful experience of feeling or having knowledge or an experience that feels as if it came from something other than the person who's actually hearing it.
Well, and you know, on that level, I've had that experience myself.
Sure, sure, absolutely. Yeah. So have I.
So
I've even had it once or twice in the sort of outside your own head experience. I think a lot of us have. You know, walking through a store, I've heard my wife's voice calling my name, or a lot of times when we have this experience, and I've certainly had this, when you're sort of drifting off to sleep.
Right.
And I always get mixed up. There's a drifting off to sleep and waking up. It's hypnagogic or hypnopompic imagery that the psychologists call it. Maybe you know. And this is one of the most common states, psychological states, in which people hear voices. And I've certainly had it.
Well, and I wonder if just walking through the store, if you can't find yourself in that place where you're kind of drifting off, daydreaming, not really paying attention. So
either that or I'm very well trained.
Yeah. Could well be. All right. Our guest this hour is Daniel B. Smith. He is the author of Muses, Madmen, and Prophets. He is based in New York, where he is actively engaged in journalism. New article out in the New York Times Magazine. If you'd like to call in and ask him a question, 1-800-259-9231. We'll be right back.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Dan Smith, author of Muses, Madmen, and Prophets. a detailed exploration into not only the phenomenon of hearing voices, but also the history of it, which, Dan, I've got to tell you, is one of the things that I found so interesting about the book, especially because I've developed recently this fascination with classical literature, and it is clear you are extremely well-read. You must have probed everything ever written on this topic, going back all the way to antiquity. Tell us how the ancients interpreted this event.
Well, the sort of big figure in this, classically speaking, is Socrates, who a lot of people don't realize this about Socrates. It's one of the interesting things that I think some historians have done in trying to cut against his reputation is to show that what shows up in a lot of the Platonic dialogues about Socrates and what even shows up in other lesser-known writings about him is that he heard voices. One of the ways he heard it was, or the particular way that he heard it, and I think it's important to say that hearing voices has always been sort of diversely interpreted phenomenon. But Socrates heard voices that seemed to signal to him to either stop doing something or to continue doing something. It was almost this sort of this guide, but thought of it in religious terms, specifically as a sort of a daimonion is what they call it, a personal god, a personal demon that was able to carry along with him and help him out almost like a guardian angel. And there are some great little anecdotes, probably most of them not true, that also cut against the idea of this is a very serious experience. One of my favorites is Socrates walking down a street with some friends, and he says that his personal deity here has told him to not to go down that road. And his friends all make fun of him and say, you know, you're crazy, don't worry about it. And so he goes off, and in fact, all his friends get caught in this street where it's a mad rush of muddy pigs to get them all filthy and knock them over, and he's all clean. It's probably not true. I think it was written a couple hundred years later, but that seems to be the sort of feel of Socrates' voice, which is as a sort of something that just told them to do or not to do things that often weren't serious. But then again, it was also probably, and I'm convinced that it was one of the major influences in his trial and his execution.
Well, and the story that you relate there about the pigs kind of reminds me of your story of your grandfather playing cards in a retirement home, and the voice tells him which card to keep or which card to discard. So it's almost like these voices can be petty at times, even when they have insights that go beyond our human understanding. We're not talking about profound earth-shattering realizations. We're talking about really mundane sorts of things in many cases.
Yeah, they can be profound, but I think a lot of it has to do with the interpretation of course. But yeah, a lot of times they're simply petty. And when I say that it has to do with the interpretation of it, I think it's kind of the emotional interpretation. You know, despite the fact that my father's voices were pretty petty, he was horrified by them. And my grandfather's voices, being although they were petty, he felt fine about them. So it's probably a matter of sort of emotional and psychological constitution as much as anything else. But I also think that has a lot to do with how the culture itself interprets it. Socrates happened to live at a time when it was interpreted polytheistically. This doesn't say that it was accepted. Like I said, I think at that time there were certain rules, religious rules, and if you didn't follow them, you were suspect. And he was suspect. I think it's always been a suspect experience simply because no one else really has access to it. This makes it hard to write about and hard to understand because it is strictly and utterly subjective. You have to take the person's word for it. And that's a tough thing to do.
Well, and in the case, you raised something kind of interesting, or at least in my mind, it raised a pretty serious question when Socrates' personal deity there actually is the Greek word that I believe is where we derive the word demon from, mm-hmm. in English, the word daimonion. Mm-hmm. That was the one thing I kind of kept flipping through pages and flipping through pages looking for that interpretation in your book. And while you cover the religious experiences of Muhammad and Joan of Arc and people who have had sort of positive influences, or at least their followers would say, from these voices, there really wasn't a big chunk that I was kind of expecting to stumble across in your book that would talk about that sort of demonic interpretation. And for so many people who have these voices, that really is how they experience them, as really negative, angry, ugly, evil types of influences inside their minds.
Well, there is the interpretation, the sort of demonic interpretation in terms of how the culture and the authorities tend to interpret it. There isn't that, you're right, in terms of how sort of the person who's actually hearing the voices interprets it. Or maybe that's not true. There are a couple of psychiatric patients who actually do experience it that way. There's Daniel Paul Schreiber, who is someone whom Freud wrote about and who was horrified by his voices, at least in the beginning, and who did interpret them in sort of demonic ways. I didn't want to get into the sort of interpretation of it as negative by the person itself, in large part just because I did think of this as sort of a redemptive project for my father. But then again, Joan of Arc was burnt at the stake for precisely that reason, because the way that the Greeks thought of it is as a personal deity was transformed at that time into the Inquisition, and into a way of demonizing individual experiences. Joan of Arc happened to be strong enough in mind to not be convinced by that herself, at least not for a long period of time.
But she lived in a period of time where it was considered to be visionary rather than mental illness. And so when she began hearing voices as a young girl, she interpreted them as the voice of God. And indeed, the voices said, here I am, divine inspiration for you, and gave her access to information. So I don't think that she would have the experience that your father would have in the 1950s, of saying, gee, this must mean if I tell anybody, I'm going to be locked in a mental institution. She might have been able to reasonably predict that if she told anybody, she would be canonized as a saint. And indeed, that's what happened.
Well, canonized as a saint, but it's important to remember that the history of the saints is not a happy one. A lot of these people are canonized long after being drawn, quartered, burned at the stake, put on trial, humiliated, put in dungeons. And a lot of the reason is that because these experiences that are interpreted as visionary are interpreted as visionary after the fact, as is the case of Joan of Arc. Joan of Arc wasn't canonized until long after she was dead.
Right, and she was burned at the stake in part because of concerns about the voices that she heard.
Almost wholly, I'd say.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, our guest this hour, Dan Smith. If you'd like to weigh in, give us a call, 1-800-259-9231, or email me, kma@spychips.com. Stay with us.
Thank you for listening to GCN. Be sure to visit GCNlive.com today.
Inside my lost tooth, I strain to listen. Just let go your solid chains and face eternity.
All right, we're back. Our guest this hour, Daniel B. Smith. And Dan, one of the things I found really interesting in your book were your own efforts to try to understand or better understand your father's experience by hearing your own voices, by trying to kind of create or replicate that experience. Tell our listeners some of the things that you attempted.
Yeah, there were sort of follies from the beginning, and that I suspected I wouldn't be very successful. And the things you need to do in order to hear voices, if you don't already, are kind of scary. There are certain things that we know cause voices, and one of them is to become a raging alcoholic and then to stop drinking, or to overdose on methamphetamine. So I wasn't exactly going to go to those lengths, not for a book. This seems like the drugs that you can take this to have hallucinations are almost always visual, probably because there's a market for it. But what I ended up doing was, at one point, there's an organization called the National Empowerment Society, I think. In any event, they produce an audio tape in order to train policemen or mental health workers or family members of people who hear voices to experience what it's like. And this audio tape is sort of pretty terrifying enactment of auditory hallucinations, of hearing voices. So in one case, I got a Walkman and I put in the tape and I did what they told me to do, which is to try to go about your day listening to these voices. The attempt was actually to experience what my father experienced, but I couldn't do that because this tape was, they were supposed to be schizophrenic voices. So they were exactly the type that you were talking about earlier, persecutory, demonic, horrific, really, absolutely disturbing. And, it was eye-opening. It seems that there have been a couple of companies who have done this now and a couple of other organizations where they put together videos videotapes or audio tapes where you can actually experience what it's like to be schizophrenic and as a way of almost increasing your empathy. And they work.
Well, and, you know, on the basis, just to jump in here, the National Empowerment Center, I actually, on your advice, I gave them a call to see if I could get a copy of this audio tape, and they're going to be sending it to me in the mail so I can report back to our listeners what that experience is like and maybe take a portion of it and digitize it. They don't have it in MP3 yet. They said they need to kind of get up with the times here on the technology.
I don't even
it's still
know if
a cassette.
CD.
Yeah, no, I think it's a cassette still.
You have to
go dig a Walkman out of a thrift store somewhere to play this darn thing.
I had to buy one. Yeah.
So anyway, they're going to be sending me that. So that should be kind of an interesting experience. You also tell in the book about another experience that we have shared, which is not simultaneously, but the flotation chamber.
Oh, have you done that?
I have. And I found it to be an extraordinary experience, although it never dawned on me that you could use sensory deprivation in a flotation tank to hear voices. And your experience was absolutely, I found it hilarious.
I'm glad. It was supposed to be a sort of comic relief. Yeah, I mean, people apparently had done this in the past. I came across it in something by the physicist Richard Feynman, and he had come across it, the inventor of the tank, whose name I forget right now, it escapes me, but he was a sort of, sort of guru in the 60s and early 70s, and these flotation tanks just popped up all over the place. And I know there's a movie, I think with William Hurt, in which he sort of regresses through these flotation tanks, turns into an ape or something like that.
Yeah.
Altered States, that's the movie. But in any case, yeah, I found one of the remaining sensory deprivation chambers in New York. It's run by this guy whose organization is called Blue Light Flotation. It's in his apartment in Chelsea. And you sort of go in, and he tells you take a shower and wash off all your bodily oils and anything that might contaminate the tank. And you dive on in there. Richard Feynman, I think, had more success than I did. A, because he had access to one at a friend's house that he was able to spend hours and hours in. And B, because he got stoned before he went in, which I did not do. And I had a little bit of success, I'd say, in that you could sort of see how sensory deprivation throughout history has caused these experiences. Muhammad on the mountaintop, Moses on the mountaintop, in these very desolate, silent, dark places, in caves. This is why religious figures have always done this, because they think that it brings them closer to this sensory appreciation of the divine. And it sort of has a bit of a connection to prayer, I would say. I'm not religious myself, but in reading a lot of these religious texts, you could see the connection very clearly. But it was an odd experience. I don't know if you've done it more than once. I did it a couple times.
Yeah, I have. And in fact, I was just cautioning people not to buy gift cards or gift certificates for people for Christmas. And the one time that I fell into that, I actually bought a 4 flotation series for my husband. And then the company went out of business, so we never got a chance to use them. So I
just lock them in the bathroom. In the top.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, my gosh. So, yeah, so I watched that just evaporate as we called them up and they were gone.
Yeah, well, they're all, you know, there's only a couple left on the East Coast now, and they're a little bit out of fashion.
Well, I found it to be an extraordinary experience. You never fully lost consciousness in your flotation tank, and I have kind of fallen. It feels like you fall asleep, but when you wake up, the world is totally different. It's really a bizarre experience, and in fact, the most amazing part afterwards is eating. Like drinking, the woman at the first place I ever did it gave us herbal tea, and it tasted like nothing I've ever tasted in my life. It was like an explosion of flavor in my taste buds. It was unbelievable. And the colors were different. Everything was just my senses were so heightened. They were like sponges to absorb input, and it was just an incredible experience. But I did not hear any voices, though.
Well, neither did I. I mean, I did start to hear simple noises, you know, sort of little things here and there. A lot of times you're hearing the sounds of your own body. And they must have some form they need to adhere to, because I got herbal tea afterwards also.
Okay.
And I have heard lots of people say that, you know, their senses are just heightened and they, like, exactly what you described, is sort of like they feel like a sponge for sensory experiences. I must be jaded because I didn't experience that.
Well, you drank coffee.
Because
you drank coffee. You drank coffee before you went in there.
That was some. I had an assignment due. So I'm also addicted. So, yeah, they tell you not to have coffee beforehand. And I might have been hungover also. It was not it didn't work out.
Optimal. And probably having an assignment due wasn't the most relaxing thing either. I want to read you an email that came in from Brian in Austin, Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to jump ahead to the juicy part here.
Sure.
He says, talking about hearing voices. Hang on, let me jump ahead. Brain waves, theta and gamma waves specifically. He's discussing all the things he's looked into.
Mm-hmm.
When you increase your theta brain waves, a harmonic effect will trigger an increase in gamma waves as well. And you know all the flotation people talk about these waves.
Sure.
These gamma waves are highest when people hear these voices, and coincidentally, they're most elevated when Buddhist monks meditate. But then he goes on and talks about binaural beats. Did you hear about this?
No.
He says it's a way of syncing your brain waves to a frequency of your choosing, and he himself uses this technique regularly and can trigger voices within 5 to 10 minutes in his own head by syncing these theta waves to around 4 to 5 hertz.
Well, my question to him would be, well, why does he want to do this?
Yeah.
I mean, a few people want to, I mean, I, you know, my desire to hear voices is kind of literary, but I wouldn't imagine why anyone else would want to do it for recreation.
Well, you know, why do people want to see hallucinations? Why do they drop acid? Why do people do all the many, many things that they've done to alter their perception and see things that aren't
there?
I guess that's true.
Yeah.
So I guess, and you just revealed your own bias there, that there is more of a market for the visual than the auditory hallucinations.
I'm afraid.
All right, we'll be right back.
Are you tired of searching for great talk radio? Well, search no more. We are the GCN Radio Network.
Sure.
playing, I want to let everybody know this is the persecutorial voice. Listen to how awful this is.
We used to have some friends, but they don't come around much anymore. Probably because it's hard for them to keep a straight face in your presence. Out, you need to be very careful. Things always seem to happen too fast. If someone accidentally brushes against you, you jerk away in a panic that you foolishly hope no one will notice.
Thing goes on for like 8 minutes of this. It's probably the closest, Dan, that I could get to the audio tape that I've ordered, kind of with that the ugliness. You know, they're all watching you and they know what you're doing. And I wanted to play that because in our last segment here, I want to talk about an experience that both you and I have had, which is being contacted by people who hear these voices are very disturbed by them and who really do believe, especially the segment we just heard about the video camera, the security camera watching them. I have had, and I don't think it's an exaggeration to say probably 200 or 300 people contact me believing that they've been implanted with microchips, because that's my area of privacy expertise. Mm-hmm. And these voices that they hear in their heads, they believe that someone's implanted them and is watching them. What did you find in your research about that phenomenon?
Well, I have to tell you that I didn't dive into that as much as you would think. Nor was I contacted by as many people as it seems that you were contacted by. And I think that the reason might be is that it's a slightly different phenomenon than hearing voices. In that psychiatry thinks of it as a delusion, a sort of false, a belief without with all evidences to the contrary. Of course, that gives it, you know, there's a strong relationship between that and hearing voices or seeing things, but it's not exactly the same thing. And I expected to be contacted by many more people of that stripe. So I'm not sure I could shed much light on it, except that both of them seem to be amenable to psychotherapy, actually. I mean, you wouldn't think so. I mean, we always think of these things, and I'm sorry if I'm not talking exactly to what you might like.
Well, no. What I did want to clarify is that the people who contact me do hear voices. I'll never forget being on the phone the first time. You know, initially when these people contacted me, I sat down and I would spend hours with each one of them trying to help them out. You know, I have a background in psychology. I try to be a helpful, nice person in the world.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't like blowing people off who are obviously hurting or having a bad experience. But I'll never forget one time that someone said, I believe I have an implant and it's allowing people to talk inside my head. And they're talking to me all the time. And I said, well, you know, what sorts of things do they say? And she said, well, right now they're telling me that it's okay to talk to you.
Yeah.
And then I said, well, you know, there's a guy you might want to contact. And I referred them to a Harvard researcher. And she said, oh, the voices just told me. You know what they just said? They said, he's one of us. And I got, like, goosebumps, cold chills that, you know, everything I said, these voices were commenting inside her head in the midst of our conversation.
I mean, I'm not sure what I could say about those experiences that's at all enlightening other than the fact that they're horrifying and just absolutely horrific for the people who experience them. There's this one guy who I interviewed for the book, one of the most fascinating guys that I've met in the course of my research, or read about for that matter. And this guy heard a whole bunch of different voices, and some of them were of that type, sort of that classically persecutory, what we think of real schizophrenic voices. But of course, it diminishes the experience just to say it's schizophrenic, because it almost cuts off any other thinking about it. It's like, okay, they're crazy. But in fact, there's some logic to that, in that it's impossible to know why these people experience that. They're, you know, what is it about their mind that leads them to feel as if there's a microchip implanted in their head that's broadcasting certain things to them? What I did find is that it's not exactly a surprising finding that researchers have discovered, which is that this is relatively new, and that how people hear voices and what they hear, both how and what, tends to go along with the historical period that they're living in. So many less people hear those voices of devils or imps or ghosts in the woods than they did in the Middle Ages. During Victorian times, when everybody was wrapped up in ghosts and all that, a lot of more people saw ghosts and heard the voice of spirits and so on, because that was very popular. Now, when we live in such a vastly technological age, and there are a lot of things about technology to be legitimately frightened of, many more people hear these types of voices. And I think it might be as simple as that people's fears about the world that they live in feed into this experience.
Is it actually the case that the percentage of people within society who actually hear audible voices is increasing?
Well, you know, it's a difficult thing for two reasons to answer, and one is that it's such a subjective experience that it's very hard to get statistics on, like you would with diseases, what we think of as physical diseases. The other thing is that how do you go back in history and really look at it? One figure I saw that was interesting was that, they did find statistics in a single hospital, and what they were able to track. And there was also a very good study that was done in the late 19th century that the philosopher William James was involved in. And what they found is that during that time, many more people saw things than they did hear voices. And the researchers thought that maybe this had to do with exactly what I just said, which is that people were obsessed with ghosts and spirits. And also photography was just becoming a technology in the beginning of the 20th century. So this fed into what people experienced. As for whether more people hear things than they ever did, I tend to think that it's probably always been a high percentage of us that have had the experience the way that you've had it or the way that I've had it, sort of in a very simple, mundane, drifting off to sleep, or like I said, my wife calling my name in the store. But as far as the percentage of those that hear it in a difficult manner, I think it's probably stayed pretty steady, I'd say.
Yeah, well, and we have reports going all the way back, but it certainly seems like there's an explosion. It's probably just my exposure to it, talking to so many of these folks, and they all have similar experiences. Very disturbing. Dan, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the show.
Likewise. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, I really appreciate your joining us and sharing your expertise. Our guest, of course, this hour, Dan Smith, author of Muses, Mad Men, and Prophets, available through the Penguin Press. I would also encourage you to look out for Dan's writing. He has a new article out, not on this topic, but he's moved on to other things in the New York Times Magazine and elsewhere. We look forward to hearing a lot more from you in the future, Dan. And meanwhile, everybody else, have a great weekend. We'll see you all on Monday. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.